Funding for WBUR comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This week in WBUR's series on immigrants, which we're calling Invisible Communities, we visited New Bedford and Manchester, New Hampshire. Today, it's Lowell, where Cambodian immigrants make up about 10% of the city's population and where gang violence has damaged many lives. WBUR's Bianca Vasquez-Tunis reports on two young men who want to change that. But before we hear Bianca's story, we speak with Shirley S. Tang, Associate Professor of Asian American Studies and American Studies at the University of Massachusetts, Boston. Professor Tang joined us recently to talk about why Cambodians settled in cities such as Lynn and Lowell in the 1980s and 90s.
Following the Khmer Rouge genocide in the aftermath of the Vietnam War, many Cambodian refugees were resettled in Massachusetts, in Boston, Revere, Chelsea, Fall River, and Amherst. In the early 1980s, after a Cambodian Buddhist temple was built in the Lowell area, many Cambodians migrated from other parts in the country and established what has been the second largest Cambodian American community in the U.S. for the past 20 years. Its size is only next to Long Beach, California.
Why did so many Cambodians in Lowell and also Lynn get involved in gangs and gang violence?
Bob, we are talking about people who have survived war and genocide. In the early years of resettlement during the 1980s, Cambodian refugees faced intense racial violence, ranging from vandalism and harassment to firebombing and murder. And so Cambodian-American gang activity actually emerged as, I would argue, an adaptive response to racial violence by young people to claim identity and to gain protection in schools and on the street.
Professor, stay with us as we listen to a story about how some of those Cambodian youth got caught up in gangs. Mm-hmm. Some of the survivors of gangs are trying to become legitimate. They want to be visible to the public in a positive way. And we hear that story now from WBUR's Bianca Vasquez-Tunis.
Johnny Chang grew up feeling invisible.
I feel like I was just left out from the community. People look at me like, oh, this dude doesn't know how to speak English. He doesn't know anything about American, how they work.
His family life wasn't much better. His parents didn't talk about their traumatic experience in Cambodia, and he couldn't share his school troubles with them.
I don't really speak Cambodian proper, so we don't really communicate right. You know, I'm speaking American, and now they're talking Cambodian, and then we're just bumping heads.
So Chang found comfort on the streets. Cambodian kids struggling with the same things he was. He also found something he was good at, management. He quickly rose to the top of the Moonlight Strangers gang. You've probably heard of the Bloods and the Crips. Johnny's gang was sort of a local chapter of the Bloods.
Well, yeah, at that moment, I liked that. That was power, you know. That was power. That was, you know, that was a reputation. That was everything to me.
Johnny's charisma was like a magnet for young teenage boys.
I was just a follower.
Ricky Lee was one of Johnny's recruits. And what happened between them is a classic tale of American gang life, complete with tragedy and redemption. Ricky got into Johnny's gang with a ritual called a jump-in. Members beat up a new recruit to initiate them and test if they can survive.
It was in the bathroom. Had 5 against 1.
Ricky did survive, and for a while he enjoyed being a gangster. He and his buddies drove stolen cars, drank, and smoked weed. But
I went to high school freshman year, starting to see the real side of gangbanging, and it was a little too much. It was too much for me.
What really bothered him was when he was supposed to fight his friends in rival gangs. He didn't want to do that, so he did something really brave.
I wanted out, so I told my friend who was the shot caller for the gang, my set.
Shot caller is gang speak for the boss, and the boss, of course, was Johnny.
At that moment, we didn't have a lot of people in my set. You know, we only had like a few. We only had like, you could say 13 or 12, you know, but we were just trying to get more people. But, you know, every time we recruit people, it was always the wrong person, you know. That person ended up ratting on me, or that person ended up doing something he ain't supposed to do, you know. He's not following the rules, so, you know, the consequences getting jumped out, you know.
Jumping out of the gang is like jumping in, but a lot worse. Ricky and three others went to a park where Johnny and the rest would do the ceremony.
They started jumping out. A few people before me, so I just waited there. I was nervous because they were giving my friends a good beating.
Ricky went last.
They jumped me out. There was a lot of guys.
I didn't really want to go that route, you know. It was really bad, you know. It was supposed to be a 30-second jump out, but then it turns out he was, you know, 99% a vegetable.
Somewhere around 15 men brutalized Ricky. They kicked him, stomped on his head, and swung crowbars at his body. Some of the men pummeled him with padlocks inside socks. When they realized Ricky wasn't responding, Johnny and the others took Ricky's limp body and left him in the emergency room. Ricky was in a coma for 10 days.
It was the hardest part of my life, and still is.
When he woke up, Ricky had tubes down his throat. He couldn't eat real food. When the physical therapist took him out of his bed, he crumpled to the ground. He couldn't walk. His brain was injured. It's been 7 years since the jump out, and Ricky still hasn't finished high school.
Oh, no, it's just so frustrating. People think that just because I look normal, I mean, you see me walking, you'll be like, oh, Ricky's fine. And they come up to me like, oh, haven't seen you in a long time. Oh, are you working or are you in school? Are you driving? It's like, all my answers is no. And they're like, oh, you're just lazy.
While Ricky was trying to recover, Johnny went to prison. He got 5 years for attempted murder.
When you locked up in a cell for 23-hour lockdown, you're going to have a lot of madness coming at you and a lot of grudges and aggressiveness.
Johnny was mad at Ricky for wanting out of the gang, and he was mad that he went to prison when he says half of the men who participated in the jump out didn't do any time. When it was time to leave prison, Johnny had to make a decision: go straight and face the world with the reputation of an ex-convict, or go back to his old gang with even better street credentials.
I could easily do the same thing and flood low with gangs and flood low with drugs and stuff, you know. But I feel like, you know, there's another positive side that I could do that could change my group to make the hood a better place, you know. I probably can't save the whole hood, but I could save certain pieces.
As Johnny started thinking about leaving the gang, he says he started to feel better. In his words, he started to heal.
That's when I start asking Ricky, you know. I'm like, you know what, I shouldn't be even mad about who got locked up or who didn't get locked up. I should be more mad about the person that almost lost his life. So, and I start healing down a little bit and start, you know, opening up my arms for Ricky and asking for him and finding any kind of access. But the thing is, I couldn't, because I couldn't stay near him. I couldn't come near him.
There was a court order barring Johnny from going within 100 feet of Ricky.
Every night I go to sleep and I was like, I want to leave low. I want to start a new life. I want to just be in a countryside or somewhere in, you know, down south, start a business or something, you know. Because I get a lot of approach here, you know, like, oh, I remember you. You was in the newspaper. You was on a run. You beat that kid up and stuff, you know. And, you know, sometimes I feel bad for myself, you know, because I don't want that reputation.
So Johnny got serious about turning his life around, and he proved it to officials and friends. Those same friends helped him ask Ricky for a meeting. Ricky was nervous about seeing Johnny. His friends and family thought it was a reckless idea. But Ricky agreed. He needed to know what Johnny would say. And he still worried that Johnny blamed him for everything that happened.
That he's pissed at me for the fact that he went to jail for beating me up.
But it didn't go that way.
When we seen each other, I smiled and it was the best thing. And then when we got to hug each other, you know, it was just, I'm going to remember that for a long, long time.
What did it feel like to hug him?
To have, to rest. You could say it was like it rest my soul. Like, I was angry, all these mixed emotions, they laid to rest, because, you know, at least somebody came up and said, "Ricky, I'm sorry." And I mean, people might think he's lying about it, but I don't think he's lying when he says sorry.
How can you forgive a guy who caused you this much pain, who beat you up so badly and made the call for other people to do it?
I can't. There's no words. I don't know. There's something about him.
Obviously, Ricky has a hard time with this question. And maybe that's because he knows it's hard for others to understand. But when he's around Johnny, Ricky lights up and laughs. And if you ask him why he likes Johnny, he doesn't have any trouble answering.
Yeah, Johnny was like an older brother, you know. I looked up to him, and, you know, he showed me, you know, that he cared for me. You know, when we played ball together, you know, my older brother never done that with me. He still doesn't.
Johnny and Ricky now frequent the same teen center in Lowell. It's a decent life compared to many of their old friends from their gang days, who are either still in jail, dead, or deported back to Cambodia. Johnny works there counseling teenagers, and Ricky has been trying to complete their GED program for almost 4 years. Johnny talks a lot about doing a road show with Ricky. He wants people to know about their reconciliation. He wants to be known for something other than the jump out. It's all part of his project to save the hood. But if you really push him, he'll admit he's also saving himself. For WBUR, I'm Bianca Vasquez-Tonis.
We're joined in the studio again by Professor Shirley Tang from UMass Boston. I was struck when I was listening to the story about how similar the Cambodian story is to the story of other immigrant Americans, especially the Irish and the Italians. Mm. Some assimilated quietly into life here. Others, especially in Boston and New York, became involved in politics, and some assimilated by joining gangs. What makes the Cambodian story different?
I think the experiences with deportation, it is a big issue facing the community now. If they received felony convictions and still had not become U.S. citizens, they are automatically deportable. So we are talking about a group of people who actually came to the United States after the genocide. Now they are being deported back to the homeland that they were trying to flee. And so the dream of finding peace and freedom in the United States has been shattered.
Is the community overcoming some of its problems, or are things getting worse?
Like many under-resourced minority and immigrant communities, the economic recession has been very, very hard in Lowell, as well as in cities like Lynn, Revere, Fall River, with high concentrations of Cambodians. On the other hand, Lowell does have some very strong, nationally recognized organizations and institutions that deserve more attention. And for all the stories of gangs, violence, and deportation, they are also inspiring stories of civic engagement, homeland reconnection, and educational achievement.
So the story continues.
The story continues.
Professor Tang, thanks a lot for coming in. Nice meeting you.
Thanks for having me, Bob.
Shirley S. Tang is Associate Professor of Asian American Studies and American Studies at UMass Boston.